Blog Talk Radio.
John. Here, you've earned this. Sure you wrote it big enough?
Mm, yes, old King George should be able to see that.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, a decent respect requires that they declare the causes which impel them. And separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to establish new government. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, do and with the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved of all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. In the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
So many people out there fail, not because they don't have the ability. It's because they don't have the heart to go through adversity.
The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it.
You'll go through some failures.
When you're in that darkness, you want to sit there and wait for the light to come. But you can't wait. The only way out is to step forward, to face your fears, to become your own light. There's going to be a lot of times y'all about to fail. We are all a work in progress. But in that moment, I want you to remember the power of you. You will change the world.
Even when you're struggling, even when you're discouraged, and you feel like other people have given up on you, don't ever give up on yourself.
The indomitable will, if you have a belief, you can do something. The only way you grow that, like in the gym, you grow your muscles by actually exercising them. To grow the individual will to become something, you must get comfortable with fear and failure. They must be your best friends. They're the only one that moves that needle of life. Every hero you guys had was called an idiot, crazy, a loser. You must break society's status quo. Status quo is normality. It's alive but not living. It's death on a stick, guys. The belief of the individual overrides thousands of people with just intent. Safety, comfort zones are dead zones. You have to continue to push yourself because your true potential will never be matched, guys.
Nobody is going to hit as hard as life, but it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward, how much you can take and keep moving forward. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth, but you got to be willing to take the hits.
The future rewards those who press on. With patient and firm determination, I'm going to press on.
I don't have time to feel sorry for myself. I don't have time to complain. I'm going to press on. Stop complaining. Stop crying. We are going to press on. We've got work to do.
What's your why? What motivates you? What pushes you? What drives you? And if that thing is internal, if nobody has to call you, if nobody has to prod you, if nobody has to reward you, if nobody has to give you anything, if you are self-motivated and self-regulated, you can have it. You can be it. You can do it.
Take ownership. Take extreme ownership. Don't make excuses. Don't blame any other person or any other thing. Get control of your ego. Take ownership of everything in your world, the good and the bad. Take ownership of your mistakes. Take ownership of your shortfalls. Take ownership of your problems. And then take ownership of the solutions that will get those problems solved. Take ownership of your mission. Take ownership of your job, of your team, of your future, and take ownership of your life and lead to victory.
It's possible you can live your dream. It's necessary that you have a plan of action, that you're resilient, that you stick to, and you work with the system, that you have the vision and never give up, that you become creative and relentless and keep on coming back again and again and again, and that it's you that you got to take personal responsibility to make it happen, and that it's hard, easy is not an option, and when life knocks you down, jump back up and say, it's not over until I win.
So quiet. Where all the Trumpies at, right? That's what I've been hearing. We've been here the whole time. We don't need a safe space. We don't burn down our cities. We don't riot when things don't go our way. And if we lose a fair one, then we accept defeat with humility. But when you try to rob from us, steal from us, and cheat us, then you just started a fight that you're not ready for.
Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past.
The death of bin Laden marks the most significant achievement to date in our nation's effort to defeat Al-Qaeda.
All you got to do is start looking around, start thinking for yourself, start investigating things, and you will see it all right there. So you have the power. Humanity has the power. We have the power. Do you want to fight? You better believe you've got one!
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
And for me, give me liberty or give me death!
The answer to 1984 is 1776.
Blowout, number three.
Pitch your pitch to zero.
Pitch it out again. Hold out to two.
Direction out.
Flight calm. I can't hold it. Roger, everybody. Joseph Gibson podcasting here live, understanding the times in which we live today. Okay, we're going to continue on with the Money Masters documentary here. I'm going to play the Money Masters, and then I got something for Common Law. Those are the people out there. Phone number 657-383-0616. Usually I check callers to make sure none of the spammers are out there. But if you got something you want to add here, conversation at the end of the podcast, let me know. We'll try to up a little bit earlier here tonight. We'll see what happens. See if we can get to a couple news stories here. Let's see here. The Money Masters. Let's see. Where did we leave off last night? We left off, okay, right about there. All right. What we'll do is we'll continue on here and enjoy the podcast.
Proposed bill to the Congress calling for a new privately owned central bank. Coincidentally, that was the very year that Amschel Rothschild made this pronouncement from his flagship bank in Frankfurt.
Well, we might not be getting the Money Masters here tonight. We've got to, hang on here, let's refresh that. I tried to leave it off right where they stopped off, see what happens. If not, I got a backup. Here we go. All right, okay. We'll go to a quick commercial here, and I got something else. We'll go to the Common Law, and I'll try to fix that for everybody, see what the heck happens here. All right, let's see here. Go here. Give it another shot here, the Money Masters, and we'll go over from there about banking.
The men behind the Bank of North America, Alexander Hamilton, Robert Morris, and the bank's president, Thomas Wiling, did not give up. Only 6 years later, Hamilton, then Secretary of the Treasury, and his mentor, Morris, rammed a new privately owned central bank through the new Congress. Called the first bank of the United States, Thomas Wiling again served as the bank's president. The players were the same, only the name of the bank was changed. In 1787, colonial leaders assembled in Philadelphia to replace the ailing Articles of Confederation. As we saw earlier, both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were unalterably opposed to a privately owned central bank. They had seen the problems caused by the Bank of England. They wanted nothing of it. As Jefferson later put it, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations which grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. During the debate over the future monetary system, another one of the founding fathers, Gouverneur Morris, castigated the motions of the owners of the Bank of North America. Gouverneur Morris headed the committee that wrote the final draft of the Constitution. Morris knew the motivations of the bank well. Along with his old boss, Robert Morris, Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton were the ones who had presented the original plan for the Bank of North America to the Continental Congress in the last year of the Revolution. In a letter he wrote to James Madison on July 2, 1787, Gouverneur Morris revealed what was really going on.
The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will. They will have the same effect here as elsewhere if we do not, by the power of government, keep them in their proper spheres.
Despite the defection of Gouverneur Morris from the ranks of the bank, Hamilton, Robert Morris, Thomas Wiling, and their European backers were not about to give up. They convinced the bulk of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention to not give Congress the power to issue paper money. Most of the delegates were still reeling from the wild inflation of the paper currency during the Revolution. They had forgotten how well colonial scrip had worked before the war. But the Bank of England had not. The money changers could not stand to have America printing her own money again. So the Constitution is silent on the matter. This grievous defect left the door wide open for the money changers, just as they had planned. In 1790, less than 3 years after the Constitution had been signed, the money changers struck again. The newly appointed first Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, proposed a bill to the Congress calling for a new, privately owned central bank. Coincidentally, that was the very year that Amschel Rothschild made his pronouncement from his flagship bank in Frankfurt. Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws. Alexander Hamilton was a tool of the international bankers, and he wanted to create the U.S. Bank, or the U.S., or the Bank of the United States, and did so. Interestingly, one of Hamilton's first jobs after graduating from law school in 1782 was as an aide to Robert Morris, the head of the Bank of North America. In fact, the year before, Hamilton had written Morris a letter saying, "A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." A blessing to whom? After a year of intense debate, in 1791, Congress passed the bill and gave it a 20-year charter. The new bank was to be called the First Bank of the United States, or BUS. Here we are in front of the First Bank of the United States in Philadelphia. The bank was given a monopoly on printing U.S. currency, even though 80% of its stock would be held by private investors. The other 20% would be purchased by the U.S. government. But the reason was not to give the government a piece of the action. It was to provide the capital for the other 80% owners. As with the old Bank of North America and the Bank of England before that, the stockholders never paid the full amount for their shares. The U.S. government put up their initial $2 million in cash. Then the bank, through the old magic of fractional reserve lending, made loans to its charter investors so they could come up with the remaining $8 million of capital needed for this risk-free investment. Like the Bank of England, the name of the Bank of the United States was deliberately chosen to hide the fact that it was privately controlled. And like the Bank of England, the names of the investors in the bank were never revealed. Many years later, it was a common saying that the Rothschilds were the power behind the old Bank of the United States. The bank was sold to Congress as a way to bring stability to the banking system and eliminate inflation. So what happened? Over the first 5 years, the U.S. government borrowed $8.2 million from the Bank of the United States. In the same five-year period, prices rose by 72%. Jefferson, as the new Secretary of State, watched the borrowing with sadness and frustration, unable to stop it.
"I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution, taking from the federal government the power of borrowing."
Millions of Americans feel the same way today. They watch in helpless frustration as the federal government borrows the American economy into oblivion. So, although it was called the First Bank of the United States, it was not the first attempt at a privately owned central bank in this country. As with the Bank of North America, the government put up most of the cash to get this private bank going. Then the bankers loaned the money to each other to buy the remaining stock in the bank. It was a scam, plain and simple, and they wouldn't be able to get away with it for long. But first, we have to travel back to Europe to see how a single man was able to manipulate the entire British economy by obtaining the first news of Napoleon's final defeat. Here in Paris, the Bank of France was organized in 1800, just like the Bank of England. But Napoleon decided France had to break free of debt, and he never trusted the Bank of France. He declared that when a government is dependent upon bankers for money, the bankers, not the leaders of the government, are in control.
The hand that gives is above the hand that takes. Money has no motherland. Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain.
Back in America, unexpected help was about to arrive. In 1800, Thomas Jefferson narrowly defeated John Adams to become the third president of the United States. By 1803, Jefferson and Napoleon had struck a deal. The U.S. would give Napoleon $3 million in gold in exchange for a huge chunk of territory west of the Mississippi River, the Louisiana Purchase. With that $3 million, Napoleon quickly forged an army and set off across Europe, conquering everything in his path. But the Bank of England quickly rose to oppose him. They financed every nation in his path, reaping the enormous profits of war. Prussia, Austria, and finally Russia all went heavily into debt in a futile attempt to stop Napoleon. 4 years later, with the main French army in Russia, 30-year-old Nathan Rothschild, the head of the London office of the Rothschild family, personally took charge of a bold plan to smuggle a much-needed shipment of gold right through France to finance an attack by the Duke of Wellington from Spain. Nathan later bragged at a dinner party in London that it was the best business he'd ever done. Little did he know that he would do much better business in the near future. Wellington's attacks from the south and other defeats eventually forced Napoleon to abdicate, and Louis XVIII was crowned king. Napoleon was exiled to Elba, a tiny island off the coast of Italy, supposedly exiled from France forever. While Napoleon was in exile on Elba, temporarily defeated by England with the financial help of the Rothschilds, America was trying to break free of its central bank as well. In 1811, a bill was put before Congress to renew the charter of the Bank of the United States. The debate grew very heated, and the legislatures of both Pennsylvania and Virginia passed resolutions asking Congress to kill the bank. The press corps of the day attacked the bank openly, calling it a great swindle, a vulture, a viper, and a cobra. Oh, to have an independent press once again in America. A congressman named T.D. Porter attacked the bank from the floor of Congress, saying if the bank's charter was renewed, Congress, quote, will have planted in the bosom of this Constitution a viper, which one day or another will sting the liberties of this country to the heart, close quote. Prospects didn't look that good for the bank. Some writers have even claimed that Nathan Rothschild warned that the United States would find itself involved in a most disastrous war if the bank's charter were not renewed. But it wasn't enough. When the smoke had cleared, the renewal bill was defeated by a single vote in the House and was deadlocked in the Senate. By now, America's fourth president, James Madison, was in the White House. Remember, Madison was a staunch opponent of the bank. His vice president, George Clinton, broke the tie in the Senate and sent the bank into oblivion. Within 5 months, England attacked the U.S., and the War of 1812 was on. But the British were still busy fighting Napoleon, and so the War of 1812 ended in a draw in 1814. Though the money changers were temporarily down, they were far from out. It would take them only another 2 years to bring back their bank bigger and stronger than ever. But now, let's return to Napoleon. Because nothing else in history more aptly demonstrates the ingenuity of the Rothschild family than their control of the British stock market after Waterloo. In 1815, a year after the end of the War of 1812 in America, Napoleon escaped his exile and returned to Paris. French troops were sent out to capture him, but such was his charisma that the soldiers rallied around their old leader and hailed him as their emperor once again. In March of 1815, Napoleon equipped an army which Britain's Duke of Wellington defeated less than 90 days later at Waterloo. Some writers claim Napoleon borrowed £5 million from the Bank of England to rearm. But it appears these funds actually came from the Ouvrard Banking House in Paris. Nevertheless, from about this point on, it was not unusual for privately controlled central banks to finance both sides in a war. Why would a central bank finance opposing sides in a war? Because war is the biggest debt generator of them all. A nation will borrow any amount for victory. The ultimate loser is loaned just enough to hold out the vain hope of victory, and the ultimate winner is given enough to win. Besides, such loans are usually conditioned upon the guarantee that the victor will honor the debt of the vanquished. This is the Waterloo battlefield about 200 miles northeast of Paris in what today is Belgium. Here, Napoleon suffered his final defeat, but not before thousands of French and Englishmen gave their lives on a steamy summer day in July of 1815. Right over there, on 18, 1815, 74,000 French troops met 67,000 troops from Britain and other European nations. The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. But no matter who won or lost, back in London, Nathan Rothschild planned to use the opportunity to try to seize control over the British stock and bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. Rothschild stationed a trusted agent, a man Rothworth, on the north side of the battlefield, closer to the English Channel. Once the battle had been decided, Rothworth took off for the town. He delivered the news to Nathan Rothschild a full 24 hours before Wellington's own courier. Rothschild hurried to the stock market and took up his usual position in front of an ancient pillar. All eyes were on him. The Rothschilds had a legendary communications network. If Wellington had been defeated and Napoleon was loose on the continent again, Britain's financial situation would become grave indeed. Rothschild looked saddened. He stood there motionless, eyes downcast. Then suddenly he began selling. Other nervous investors saw that Rothschild was selling. It could only mean one thing. Napoleon must have won, Wellington must have lost. The market plummeted. Soon everyone was selling their consols, their British government bonds, and prices dropped sharply. But then Rothschild started secretly buying up the consols through his agents for only a fraction of their worth hours before. Myth, legend, you say? 100 years later, the New York Times ran a story which said that Nathan's grandson had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book with a stock market story in it. The Rothschild family claimed the story was untrue and libelous, but the court denied the Rothschild's request and ordered the family to pay all court costs. What's even more interesting about this story is that some authors claim that the day after the Battle of Waterloo, in a matter of hours, Nathan Rothschild came to dominate not only the bond market, but the Bank of England as well. Whether or not the Rothschild family seized control of the Bank of England, the first privately owned central bank in a major European nation and the wealthiest, one thing is certain. By the mid-1800s, the Rothschilds were the richest family in the world, bar none. They dominated the new government bond markets and branched into other banks and industrial concerns. In fact, the rest of the 19th century was known as the Age of the Rothschilds. Despite this overwhelming wealth, the family has generally cultivated an aura of invisibility. Although the family controls scores of industrial, commercial, mining, and tourist corporations, only a handful bear the Rothschild name. By the end of the 19th century, one expert estimated that the Rothschild family controlled half the wealth of the world. Whatever the extent of their wealth, it is reasonable to assume that their percentage of the world's wealth has increased since then. But since the turn of the century, the Rothschilds have cultivated the notion that their power has somehow waned even as their wealth increases. Meanwhile, back in Washington in 1816, just 1 year after Waterloo and Rothschild's alleged takeover of the Bank of England, the American Congress passed a bill permitting yet another privately owned central bank. This bank was called the Second Bank of the United States. The new bank's charter was a copy of the previous bank's. The U.S. government would own 20% of the shares of the bank. Of course, the federal share was paid by the Treasury up front into the bank's coffers. Then, through the magic of fractional reserve lending, it was transformed into loans to private investors who then bought the remaining 80% of the shares. Just as before, the primary stockholders remained a secret. But it is known that the largest block of shares, about one-third of the total, were sold to foreigners. As one observer put it, it is certainly no exaggeration to say that the Second Bank of the United States was rooted as deeply in Britain as it was in America. So, by 1816, some authors claim the Rothschilds had taken control over the Bank of England and backed a new privately owned central bank in America as well. After 12 years of manipulations of the U.S. economy on the part of the Second Bank of the U.S., the American people have had just about enough. Opponents of the bank nominated a dignified senator from Tennessee, Andrew Jackson, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, to run for president. This is his home, the Hermitage. No one gave Jackson a chance initially. The bank had long ago learned how the political process could be controlled with money. To the surprise and dismay of the money changers, Jackson was swept into office in 1828. Jackson was determined to kill the bank first opportunity and wasted no time in trying to do so. But the bank's 20-year charter didn't come up for renewal until 1836, the last year of his second term, if he could survive that long. During his first term, Jackson contented himself with rooting out the bank's employees from government service. He fired 2,000 of the 11,000 employees of the federal government. In 1832, with his re-election approaching, the bank struck an early blow, hoping Jackson would not want to stir up controversy. They asked Congress to pass a renewal bill 4 years early. Naturally, Congress complied, then sent it to the president for signing. But Jackson weighed in with both feet. Old Hickory, never a coward, vetoed the bill. His veto message is one of the great American documents. It clearly lays out the responsibility of the American government towards its citizens, rich and poor.
It is not our own citizens only who are to receive the bounty of our government. More than 8 million of the stock of this bank are held by foreigners. Is there no danger to our liberty and independence in a bank that, in its nature, has so little to bind it to our country? Controlling our currency, we receiving our public monies and holding thousands of our citizens in dependence would be more formidable and dangerous than a military power of the enemy. Each government would confine itself to equal protection and, as heaven does its rains, shower its favor alike on the high and the low, the rich and the poor. It would be an unqualified blessing. In the act before me, there seems to be a wide and unnecessary departure from these just principles.
Later that year, in July 1832, Congress was unable to override Jackson's veto. Now Jackson had to stand for re-election. Jackson took his argument directly to the people. For the first time in U.S. history, Jackson took his presidential campaign on the road. Before then, presidential candidates stayed at home and looked presidential. His campaign slogan was Jackson and No Bank. The National Republican Party ran Senator Henry Clay against Jackson, despite the fact that the bankers poured over $3 million into Clay's campaign. Jackson was reelected by a landslide in November of 1832. Despite his presidential victory, Jackson knew the battle was only beginning. The hydra of corruption is only scotched, not dead, said the newly elected president. Jackson ordered his new Secretary of Treasury, Lewis McLean, to start removing the government's deposits from the Second Bank and start placing them in the State Bank. But McLean refused to do so. Jackson fired him and appointed William J. DeWayne as the new Secretary of the Treasury. DeWayne also refused to comply with the president's requests, and so Jackson fired him as well and then appointed Roger D. Taney to the office. Taney did withdraw government funds from the bank starting on October 1, 1833. Jackson was jubilant. I have a chain. I'm ready with screws to draw every tooth and bend the stumps. But the bank was not yet done fighting. Its head, Nicholas Biddle, used his influence to get the Senate to reject Taney's nomination. Then, in a rare show of arrogance, Biddle threatened to cause a depression if the bank was not rechartered.
This worthy president thinks that because he has scalped Indians and imprisoned judges, he is to have his way with the bank. He is mistaken.
Next, in an unbelievable fit of honesty for a central banker, Biddle admitted that the bank was going to make money scarce to force Congress to restore the bank.
Nothing but widespread suffering will produce any effect on Congress. Our only safety is in pursuing a steady course of firm restriction, and I have no doubt that such a course will ultimately lead to restoration of the currency and recharter.
What a stunning revelation. Here was the pure truth revealed with shocking clarity. Biddle intended to use the money contraction power of the bank to cause a massive depression until America gave in. Unfortunately, this has happened time and time again throughout U.S. history and is about to happen again in today's world. Nicholas Biddle made good on his threat. The bank sharply contracted the money supply by calling in old loans and refusing to extend new ones. A financial panic ensued, followed by a deep depression. Naturally, Biddle blamed Jackson for the crash, saying that it was caused by the withdrawal of federal funds from the bank. Unfortunately, his plan worked well. Wages and prices sagged. Unemployment soared along with business bankruptcies. The nation quickly went into an uproar. Newspaper editors blasted Jackson in editorials. The bank threatened to withhold payments, which then could be made directly to key politicians for their support. Within only months, Congress assembled in what was called the panic session. 6 months after he had withdrawn funds from the bank, Jackson was officially censured by a resolution which passed the Senate by a vote of 26-20. It was the first time a president had ever been censured by Congress. Jackson lashed out at the bank. You are a den of vipers. I intend to rout you out, and by eternal God, I will rout you out. America's fate teetered on a knife edge.
If Congress could muster enough votes to override Jackson's veto, the bank would be granted another 20-year monopoly or more over America's money. Time enough to consolidate its already great power. Then a miracle occurred. The governor of Pennsylvania came out supporting President Jackson and strongly criticized the bank. On top of that, Biddle had been caught boasting in public about the bank's plan to crash the economy. Suddenly, the tide shifted. In April of 1834, the House of Representatives voted 134-82 against rechartering the bank. This was followed up by an even more lopsided vote to establish a special committee to investigate whether the bank had caused the crash. When the investigating committee arrived at the bank's door in Philadelphia, armed with a subpoena to examine the books, Biddle refused to give them up. Nor would he allow inspection of correspondence with congressmen relating to their personal loans and advances he made to them. He also refused to testify before the committee back in Washington. On January 8, 1835, Jackson paid off the final installment on the national debt, which had been necessitated by allowing the banks to issue currency for government bonds rather than simply issuing treasury notes without such debt. He was the only president to ever pay off the debt. A few weeks later, on January 30th, 1835, an assassin by the name of Richard Lawrence tried to shoot President Jackson, but by the grace of God, both pistols misfired. Lawrence was later found not guilty by reason of insanity. After his release, he bragged to friends that powerful people in Europe had put him up to the task and promised to protect him if he were caught. The following year, when its charter ran out, the Second Bank of the United States ceased functioning as the nation's central bank. Biddle was later arrested and charged with fraud. He was tried and acquitted, but died shortly thereafter, both tied up in civil suits. After his second term as president, Jackson retired here to the Hermitage outside of Nashville to live out his life. He is still remembered here for his determination to kill the bank. In fact, he killed it so well that it took the money changers 77 years to undo the damage. When asked what his most important accomplishment had been, Jackson replied, "I killed the bank." Unfortunately, even Jackson failed to grasp the entire picture and its root cause. Although Jackson had killed the central bank, the most insidious weapon of the money changers, fractional reserve banking, remained in use by the numerous state-chartered banks. This fueled economic instability in the years before the Civil War. Still, the central bankers were out, and as a result, America thrived as it expanded westward. During this time, the money changers struggled to regain their lost centralized power, but to no avail. Then, finally, they reverted to the old central bankers' formula, war to create debt and dependency. If they couldn't get their central bank any other way, America could be brought to its knees by plunging it into a civil war, just as they had done in 1812 after the first bank of the United States was not rechartered. 1 month after the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln, the first shots of the American Civil War were fired here at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, on April 12, 1861. Certainly, slavery was a cause for the Civil War, but not the primary cause. Lincoln knew that the economy of the South depended upon slavery, and so before the Civil War, he had no intention of eliminating it. Lincoln had put it this way in his inaugural address only 1 month earlier.
"I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it now exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so."
Even after the first shots were fired here at Fort Sumter, Lincoln continued to insist that the Civil War was not about the issue of slavery.
"My paramount objective is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it.
So what was the Civil War all about? There were many factors at play. Northern industrialists had used protective tariffs to prevent the southern states from buying cheaper European goods. Retaliated by stopping cotton imports from the south. The southern states were in a double financial bind. They were forced to pay more for most of the necessities of life while their income from cotton exports plummeted. The south was angry. But there were other factors at work. The money changers were still stunned by America's withdrawal from their control 25 years earlier. Since then, America's wildcat economy had made the nation rich, a bad example for the rest of the world. The central bankers now saw an opportunity to split the rich new nation, to divide and conquer by war. Was this just some sort of wild conspiracy theory at the time? Well, let's take a look at what a well-placed observer of the scene had to say at the time. His name was Otto Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, the man who united the German states a few years later. The division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained as one bloc and as one nation, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over the world. Within months after the first shots here at Fort Sumter, the central bankers loaned Napoleon III of France, the nephew of the Waterloo Napoleon, 210 million francs to seize Mexico and station troops along the southern border of the U.S., taking advantage of their war to violate the Monroe Doctrine and return Mexico to colonial rule. No matter what the outcome of the Civil War, a weakened America, heavily indebted to the changers, would open up Central and South America once again to European colonization and domination. The very thing America's Monroe Doctrine had forbade in 1823. At the same time, Great Britain moved 11,000 troops into Canada and positioned them menacingly along America's northern border. The British fleet went to war alert should their quick intervention be called for. Lincoln knew he was in a double bind. That's why he agonized over the fate of the Union. There was a lot more to it than just differences between the North and the South. That's why his emphasis was always on Union and not the defeat of the South. But Lincoln needed money to win. In 1861, Lincoln and his Secretary of Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, went to New York to apply for the necessary loans. The money changers, anxious to see the Union fail, offered loans at 24 to 36% interest. Lincoln said thanks, but no thanks, and returned to Washington. Lincoln sent for an old friend, Colonel Dick Taylor of Chicago, and put him on the problem of financing the war. During one meeting, Lincoln asked Taylor what he'd discovered. Taylor put it this way. Why, Lincoln, that is easy. Just get Congress to pass a bill authorizing the printing of full legal tender treasury notes, and pay your soldiers with them, and go ahead and win your war with them also. Lincoln asked if the people of the United States would accept the notes. Taylor said, "The people or anyone else will not have any choice in the matter if you make them full legal tender. They will have the full sanction of the government and be just as any money as Congress has given that express right by the Constitution." So that's exactly what Lincoln did. In 1862-63, he printed up $450 million worth of the new bills. In order to distinguish them from other banknotes in circulation, he put them in green ink on the back side. That's why the notes were called greenbacks. With this new money, Lincoln paid the troops and bought their supplies. During the course of the war, nearly $450 million worth of greenbacks were printed at no interest to the federal government. Lincoln understood who was really pulling the strings and what was at stake for the American people. This is how he explained his rationale.
The government should create, issue, and circulate all the currency and credit needed to satisfy the spending power of the government and the buying power of consumers. The privilege of creating and issuing money is not only the supreme prerogative of government, but it is the government's greatest creative opportunity. By the adoption of these principles, the taxpayers will be saved immense sums of interest. Money will cease to be master and become the servant of humanity.
A truly incredible editorial in the London Times explained the central banker's attitude towards Lincoln's greenbacks.
If this mischievous financial policy, which has its origins in North America, shall become endured down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedent in the history of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That country must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe.
The scheme was effective. So effective that the next year, 1863, with federal and Confederate troops beginning to mass for the decisive battle of the Civil War, and the Treasury in need of further congressional authority to issue more greenbacks, Lincoln allowed the bankers to push through the National Bank Act. These new national banks would operate under a virtual tax-free status and collectively have the exclusive monopoly power to create the new form of money, banknotes. Though greenbacks continued to circulate, their numbers were not increased. But most importantly, from this point on, the entire U.S. money supply would be created out of debt by bankers buying U.S. government bonds and issuing them for reserves for banknotes. As historian John Kenneth Galbraith explained it,
the numerous years following the war, the federal government ran a heavy surplus. It could not, however, pay off its debt, retire its securities, because to do so meant there would be no bonds to back the national banknotes. To pay off the debt was to destroy the money supply.
Later in 1863, Lincoln got some unexpected help from Tsar Alexander II of Russia. The Tsar, like Bismarck in Germany, knew what the international money was up to and had steadfastly refused to let them set up a central bank in Russia. If America survived and was able to remain out of their clutches, the Tsar's position would remain secure. If the bankers were successful at dividing America and giving the pieces back to Great Britain and France, both nations under control of their central banks, eventually they would threaten Russia again. So the Tsar gave orders that if either England or France actively intervened and gave aid to the South, Russia would consider such action as a declaration of war. He did the same with part of his Pacific fleet and sent them to port in San Francisco. Lincoln was reelected the next year, 1864. Had he lived, he would surely have killed the National Bank's money monopoly extracted from him during the war. On November 21, 1864, he wrote a friend the following.
The money power preys upon the nation in times of peace and conspires against it in times of adversity. It is more despotic than monarchy, more insolent than autocracy, more selfish than bureaucracy.
Shortly before Lincoln was murdered, his former Secretary of Treasury, Salmon T. Chase, bemoaned his role in helping secure the passage of the National Banking Act only 1 year earlier.
My agency in promoting the passage of the National Banking Act was the greatest financial mistake in my life. It has built up a monopoly which affects every interest in the country.
On April 14, 1865, 41 days after his second inauguration and just 5 days after Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theater. Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, lamented the death of Abraham Lincoln.
The death of Lincoln was a disaster for Christendom. There was no man in the United States great enough to wear his boots. I fear that foreign bankers, with their craftiness and torturous tricks, will entirely corrupt the exuberant riches of America and use it systematically to corrupt modern civilization. They will not hesitate to plunge the whole of Christendom into wars and chaos in order that the earth should become their inheritance.
Bismarck well understood the money changer's plan. Allegations that international bankers were responsible for Lincoln's assassination surfaced in Canada 70 years later in 1934. Gerald G. McGeer, a popular and well-respected Canadian attorney, revealed this stunning charge in a five-hour speech before the Canadian House of Commons, blasting Canada's debt-based money system. Remember, it was 1934, the height of the Great Depression, which was ravaging Canada as well. McGeer had obtained evidence deleted from the public record, provided to him by Secret Service agents at the trial of John Wilkes Booth after Booth's death. McGeer said it showed that Booth was a mercenary working for the international bankers. According to an article in the Vancouver Sun of May 2nd, 1934,
Abraham Lincoln, the martyred emancipator of the slaves, was assassinated through the machinations of a group representative of the international bankers who feared the United States president's national credit ambitions. There was only one group in the world at that time who had any reason to desire the death of Lincoln. They were the men opposed to his national currency program and would fought him throughout the whole Civil War on his policy of greenback currency.
Interestingly, McGeer claimed that Lincoln was assassinated not only because international bankers wanted to reestablish a central bank in America, but because they also wanted to base America's currency on gold. Gold they controlled. In other words, put America on a gold standard. Lincoln had done just the opposite by issuing U.S. notes, greenbacks, which were based purely on the good faith and credit of the United States. The article quoted McGeer as saying,
"They were the men interested in the establishment of the gold standard and the right of the bankers to manage the currency and credit of every nation in the world. With Lincoln out of the way, they were able to proceed with that plan and did proceed with it in the United States. Within 8 years after Lincoln's assassination, silver was demonetized and the gold standard money system set up in the United States."
Not since Lincoln has the U.S. issued debt-free United States notes. These red seal bills, which were issued in 1963, were not a new issue from President Kennedy, but merely the old greenbacks reissued year after year. In another act of folly and ignorance, the 1994 Legal Act actually authorized the replacement of Lincoln's greenbacks with debt-based notes. In other words, greenbacks were in circulation in the United States until 1994. Why was silver bad for the bankers and gold good? Simple. Because silver was plentiful in the United States. It was very hard to control. Gold was, and always has been, scarce. Throughout history, it has been relatively easy to monopolize gold, but silver has historically been 15 times more plentiful. With Lincoln out of the way, the money changer's next objective was to gain complete control over America's money. This was no easy task. With the opening of the American West, silver had been discovered in huge quantities. On top of that, Lincoln's greenbacks were generally popular. Despite the European central bankers' deliberate attacks on greenbacks, they continued to circulate in the United States, in fact, until a few years ago. According to historian W. Cleon Skousen,
right after the Civil War, there was considerable talk about reviving Lincoln's brief experiment with the constitutional monetary system. had not the European money trust intervened, it would have no doubt become an established institution.
It is clear that the concept of America printing her own debt-free money sent shockwaves throughout the European central banking elite. They watched with horror as Americans clamored for more greenbacks. They may have killed Lincoln, but support for his monetary ideas grew. On April 12, 1866, nearly 1 year to the day of Lincoln's assassination, Congress went to work at the bidding of the European central banking interests. It passed the Contraction Act, authorizing the Secretary of the Treasury to begin to retire greenbacks in circulation and thereby contract the money supply. Authors Theodore R. Thorne and Richard F. Warner explained the results of money contraction in their classic book on the subject, The Truth in Money Book.
The hard times which occurred after the Civil War could have been avoided if the greenback legislation had continued as President Lincoln had intended. Instead, there were a series of money panics, what we call recessions, which put pressure on Congress to enact legislation to place the banking system under centralized control. Eventually, the Federal Reserve Act passed on December 23, 1913.
In other words, the money changers wanted two things: the reinstitution of a central bank under their exclusive control, and two, an American currency backed by gold. Their strategy was twofold. First of all, cause a series of panics to try to convince the American people that only centralized control of the money supply could provide economic stability. And secondly, remove so much money from the system that most Americans would be so desperately poor that they either wouldn't care or would be too weak to oppose the bankers. In 1866, there was $1.8 billion in currency in circulation in the United States, about $50.46 per capita. In 1867 alone, half a billion dollars, $500 million, was removed from the U.S. money supply. 10 years later, in 1876, America's money supply was reduced to only $600 million. In other words, two-thirds of America's money had been called in by the bankers. Only $14.60 per capita remained in circulation. 10 years later, the money supply had been reduced to only $400 million, even though the population had boomed. The result was that only $6.67 per capita remained in circulation, a 760% loss in buying power over 20 years. Today, economists try to sell the idea that recessions and depressions are a natural part of something they call the business cycle. The truth is, our money supply is manipulated now just as it was before and after the Civil War. How did this happen? How did money become so scarce? Simple. Bank loans were called in and no new ones were given. In addition, silver coins were melted down. In 1872, a man named Ernest Stead was given £100,000, about $500,000, by the Bank of England and sent to America to bribe necessary congressmen to get silver demonetized. He was told that if that was not sufficient, to draw an additional £100,000 or as much more as was necessary. The next year, Congress passed the Coinage Act of 1873, and the minting of silver dollars abruptly stopped. In fact, Representative Samuel Hooper, who introduced the bill in the House, acknowledged that Mr. Stead actually drafted the legislation. But it gets even worse than that. In 1874, Stead himself admitted who was behind the scheme.
I went to America in the winter of 1872-73, authorized to secure, if I could, the passage of a bill demonetizing silver. It was in the interest of those I represented, the governors of the Bank of England. By 1873, gold coins were the only form of coin money.
But the contest over control of America's money was not yet over. Only 3 years later, in 1876, with one-third of America's workforce unemployed, the population was growing restless. People were clamoring for a return to the greenback money system of President Lincoln, or a return to silver money, anything that would make money more plentiful. That year, Congress created the United States Silver Commission to study the problem. Their report clearly blamed the monetary contraction on the national bankers. The report is interesting because it compares the deliberate money contraction by the national bankers in the Civil War to the fall of the Roman Empire.
The disaster of the Dark Ages was caused by decreasing money and falling prices. Without money, civilization could not have a beginning, and with a diminishing supply, it must languish and a must finally perish. At the Christian era, the metallic money of the Roman Empire amounted to $1,800,000,000. By the end of the 15th century, it had shrunk to less than $200,000,000. History records no other such disastrous transition as the Roman Empire to the Dark Ages.
Despite this report by the Silver Commission, Congress took no action. The next year, 1877, riots broke out from Pittsburgh to Chicago. The pictures of starving vandals lit up the sky. The bankers huddled to decide what to do. They decided to hang on. Now that they were back in control to a certain extent, they were not about to give it up. At the meeting of the American Bankers Association that year, they urged their membership to do everything in their power to put down the notion of a return to greenbacks. The ABA secretary, James Buell, authored a letter to the members which blatantly called on the banks to subvert not only Congress, but the press.
It is advisable to do all in your power to sustain such prominent daily and weekly newspapers, especially the agricultural and religious press, as will oppose the greenback issue of paper money, and that you will also withhold patronage from all applicants who are not willing to oppose the government issue of money. To repeal the act creating banknotes or to restore to circulation the government issue of money will be to provide people with money and will therefore seriously affect our individual profits as bankers and lenders. See your congressman at once and engage him to support our interest that we may control legislation.
As political pressure mounted in Congress for change, the press tried to turn the American people away from the truth. The New York Tribune put it this way on January 10th, 1878. The capital of the country is organized at last, and we will see whether Congress will dare to fly in its face. But it didn't work entirely. On February 28, 1878, Congress passed the Sherman Law, allowing the minting of a limited number of silver dollars, ending the five hiatus. This did not end gold backing of the currency, however, nor did it completely free silver. Previous to 1873, anyone who brought silver to the U.S. Mint could have it struck into silver dollars free of charge. No longer. But at least some money began to flow back into the economy again. With no further threat to their control, bankers loosened up on loans, and the post-Civil War depression was finally ended. 3 years later, the American people elected Republican James Garfield president. Garfield understood how the economy was being manipulated. As a congressman, he had been chairman of the Appropriations Committee and was a member of bank currency. After his inauguration, he slammed the money changers publicly in 1881. Whoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled, one way or another, by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate. Unfortunately, within a few weeks of making this statement, on July 2nd of 1881, President Garfield was assassinated. money changers were gathering strength fast. They began periodic policing of the flock, as they called it, by creating economic booms followed by further depressions so they could buy up thousands of homes and farms for pennies on the dollar. In 1891, the money changers prepared to take the American economy down again, and their methods and motives were laid out with shocking clarity in a memo sent out by the American Bankers Association, the ABA, an organization in which most bankers were members. Notice that this memo called for bankers to create a depression on a certain date 3 years in the future. According to the Congressional Record, here's how it read in part. On September 1st, 1894, we will not renew our loans under any consideration. On September 1st, we will demand our money. We will foreclose and become mortgagees in possession. We can take two-thirds of the farms west of the Mississippi and thousands of them east of the Mississippi as well at our price. Then the farmers will become tenants, as in England. These depressions could be controlled because America was on the gold money standard. Since gold is scarce, it's one of the easiest commodities to manipulate. People wanted silver money legalized again so they could escape the stranglehold the money changers had on gold money. People wanted silver money reinstated, reversing Mr. Stead's Act of 1873, by then called the Crime of 73. By 1896, the issue of more silver money had become the central issue in the presidential campaign. William Jennings Bryan, a senator from Nebraska, ran for president as a Democrat on the free silver issue. At the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, he made an emotional speech which won him the nomination entitled Crown of Thorns and Cross of Gold. Though Bryan was only 36 years old at the time, this speech is widely regarded as the most famous oration ever made before a political convention. In the dramatic conclusion, Bryan said,
"We will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold."
The bankers lavishly supported the Republican candidate, William McKinley, who favored the gold standard. The resulting contest was among the most fiercely contested presidential races in American history. Bryan made over 600 speeches in 27 states. The McKinley campaign got manufacturers and industrialists to inform their employees that if Bryan were elected, all factories and plants would close and there would be no work. The ruse succeeded. McKinley beat Bryan by a small margin. Bryan ran for president again in 1900 and in 1908, but fell short each time. During the 1912 Democratic Convention, Bryan was a powerful figure who helped Woodrow Wilson win the nomination. When Wilson became president, he appointed Bryan as Secretary of State, but Bryan soon became disenchanted with the Wilson administration. Bryan served only 2 years in the Wilson administration before resigning in 1915 over the highly suspicious sinking of the Lusitania, the event which was used to drive America into World War I. Although William Jennings Bryan never gained the presidency, his efforts delayed the money changers for 17 years from attaining their next goal, a new privately owned central bank for America. Now it was time for the money changers to get back to the business of a new private central bank for America. During the early 1900s, men like J.P. Morgan led the charge. One final panic would be necessary to focus the nation's attention on the supposed need for a central bank. The rationale was that only a central bank can prevent bank failures. Morgan was clearly the most powerful banker in America, and a suspected agent for the Rothschilds. Morgan had helped finance John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil empire. He had also helped finance the monopolies of Edward Harriman in railroads, of Andrew Carnegie in steel, and of others in numerous industries.
Well, on top of that, J.P. Morgan's father, Junius Morgan, had been America's financial agent to the British. After his father's death, J.P. Morgan took on a British partner, Edward Grenfell, a longtime director of the Bank of England. In fact, upon Morgan's death, his estate contained only a few million dollars. The bulk of the securities most people thought he owned were, in fact, owned by others.
All right, everybody, the Money Masters, the Money Masters. Understand the times in which we live today. It's a long documentary. Yes, it is. Yeah, the guy, I know. The audio's garbled. Yeah. Oh, well. Don't worry about it, Gavin Moorhead. Don't worry about what I do, where I am, and where I'm going. You just mind your own business. How about that, Gavin? But anyway, very good. Hey, the audio is the best I could do. I mean, I understood it when I called in. I called in the call line. I understood it. So just, you know what? Too bad. Learn something. That's the problem. You see, people are not able to learn anything. They have attention span maybe about 3.5 seconds, and that's really the problem. So we'll play a quick, and did I get kicked out of the NSM? Who cares? How about that? But anyway, people type in there. All right, we'll play a quick commercial here, and any closing thoughts to tonight's podcast show? We got about 35 minutes left after this commercial. So I did have something on common law I really wanted to play, too. So if I don't see any callers, I'm going to play that. That was very interesting, actually. So that one, the audio will be a lot better. So give me a few minutes here.
We have, as humans, we have something that no animal has. And what it's called is imagination. And what imagination allows you to do, it allows you to see it before it actually happens. What I mean by that is I need you to go 10 years into the future, 20 years into the future, and I need you to see yourself actually becoming the person you want to be. You got to live in the forward. Block the whole world out. Put some music on, some classical music, right? The piano if you need to. I don't know what you need to listen to, but I want you to take 30 minutes. Go in the closet. Go in the basement. Go to the library. Go into a room alone. And I want you to take 30 minutes, and I want you to imagine. I want you to take 30 minutes, and I want you to live it for it. See, the problem is I'm talking to some of you guys. The problem that you're having is you're living in the future, and you're living in the present. And you keep talking about the mistakes. You keep talking about the past. You keep talking about your trials. You keep talking about your situation. And I want you to know that everybody that's ever been great, everybody has had an obstacle to overcome. They've had a barrier that they had to climb. There is no individual who's ever reached success, and he didn't have to go through an obstacle or a barrier to get there. I need you to live in the future. I need you to go in your future every single day. I need you to go in your future. I need you to see what you're going to be. Listen to me. What you are to be, you are now becoming. And so you got to use your imagination. And your imagination has to take you beyond the pain. Your imagination has to take you beyond the trouble. Your imagination has to take you to the next level. We had to see ourselves there long before it happened. The second tool is we got to embrace faith. I have to have faith to believe that the things that I see 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that one day that thing is going to be successful. When I was homeless at 16, I could have quit. When I was homeless, I could have given up. There are many a days that I thought about committing suicide, but I said to myself, E, just keep imagining. Keep thinking. Keep seeing. Keep seeing what you're not now, but what you're going to be. Sometimes it's going to be hard. Sometimes you're going to look all around you, and nowhere do you see success. Nowhere do you see anything that remotely looks like success, but you got to embrace. Number two, you got to embrace the faith. You got to believe that although it's not happening right now, if you keep pressing, if you keep pushing, guess what? One day is going to be your day. That's right. I need you to say that with me. One day is going to be your day. Embrace the faith. You got to be able to see it and believe it, that when there's no evidence.
When you have a dream, it doesn't often come at you screaming in your face. dreams always come from behind you, not right between your eyes. It sneaks up on you. Sometimes a dream almost whispers, it never shouts. Very hard to hear. So you have to, every day of your lives, be ready to hear what whispers in your ear. It very rarely shouts.
That moment in time was one of the darkest moments I've had in my whole life. My motivation was out the door, like I just wanted to give up.
I need you to be who you're supposed to be. Don't let nobody stop you from being who you're supposed to be. Don't let nobody out-talk you. Don't let nobody tell you the doors are shut. Don't let nobody tell you that opportunities don't exist. Don't let nobody tell you that. I need you to be who you're supposed to be, because when you are who you're supposed to be.
Wants to chip in here, 657-383-0616, and we'll bring you on to the podcast here, except for the wise guys there, but this is a pretty good one here. I don't know if I should say this. I'm going to see how the audio plays out here. I'm going to call how it goes. If not, I'm going to play this one tomorrow night, but I'm just going to test it out here and see how it goes here. Not working, so I'm glad I was able to test it out, actually. So it's not working, so why, I don't know. So we'll give it another shot here, another route here. We'll try it another way. Well, that's what happens. So, but this is a good one, actually. This is kind of some stuff here that we really need to go over, actually. So we'll try it here. Let's try it right here and see what happens. And just a little sample here, and then Should be able to play right now. Let's see here. Come on, Al.
Okay, well, basically, like I started off a moment ago, to pique your interest, I'm gonna jump to the end of the talk and tell you what I do when I go to court. The very first thing I do with the court, before I even enter the court, I suspend the judge. The judge may not make any decision whatsoever. He cannot make a decision against me. He cannot make a decision for me. If he makes a decision against me, I'll issue a court order vacating his decision. If he makes a decision for me, I'll issue a court order vacating his decision. If I like the decision, I'll issue another order granting it. But I do not let the judge make any decision at all, not one, okay? Not on your own. There is one case, and that case is on the CD, where the judge didn't get the message, and he issued a second decision after I had vacated his first decision. And by the way, when I vacate a decision, I don't just do like judges do and issue orders. What I do is I have an introduction to the order, which is a small course in law for the judge to read. I don't care about the attorneys. But it's written for the judge. It's written on his level. And it educates him as to why it is that I'm number one and he's number two. Then I give him the order. Okay, he gets it as a package. Now, there was one judge who didn't get the message. So what I did was I fined him for contempt of court. Okay? The founding fathers really understood abuse of power. They had it up to their eyeballs with Mr. King. The old King George up there, he really was having a good time with all his military coming over and harassing us, killing our people, raping them, robbing them, and not getting convicted, not punishing his soldiers. We had it. I mean, and if you want to understand the situation, just go back and read the Declaration of Independence. That's a wonderful statement of what the problem was about and why we elected the king. guard. We didn't want to lose a king. We were very loyal as a people. But there were the abuses. The founding fathers understood this. Well, they didn't really understand it. They first tried the Confederacy. That didn't really work so well. So the Constitution was the second attempt at it. Now, in my opinion, the Constitution is one of the finest documents.
Okay, everybody, that'll be tomorrow night. We'll play that, and that will be the tomorrow night's podcast show. It's very interesting. It's something that everyone should learn. I mean, you know, everybody wants to complain and cry, and you know, look, everybody's, you know, this is where you could stand up for yourself, and, you know, I know that maybe the audio with the Money Masters was a little bit, you know, but hey. You know, hey, you know what? People sit there and they talk on their cell phones driving down the highway. You know, you can't, it's all breaking up. People talking with it on their lap. And come on, man. I'm the one that patented that, actually, where there should be a course that should be taught. I should draft up a course. I've already talked to people about this, so I've already got a patent on it. I can't find it anywhere. There should be a course that teaches people how to talk on a cell phone. Yeah. It teaches people how to talk. For instance, you always have to place the phone up to your ear, you know, depending on what kind of phone you have, you know, and never stare at your phone while talking. You know, just sarcastic type of stuff, but you can give this to children to learn. Adults may think it's funny, but the adults are the worst ones that violate this, you know, but you can't tell adults anything because they know it all, you know, and the only thing that they don't know is that they are slaves to the Federal Reserve banking cartel. Okay, that's the only thing I don't know. So, you know, fact, you know, but that's just the way it goes. I mean, it's just that people are, you know, we're out here, you know, trying to educate people and you get the smart alecks out there. They don't know any better. So anyway, but we'll probably wrap up the show here a little bit early here tonight. Check things out over there. I guess a couple people have gone over there to the NSM because I used to do a show over there on Thursday night. Well, you know, hey. So our audio was a little bit garbled. I apologize for that. But that one there, what I played was pretty clean. I see I got a few people on here on the line here tonight that did want to join in. Actually, there were some people in the chat room though. They join and then they leave. I don't know. You know, that chat room, you just never know what you're going to get in there. Hello, Sarge. I think Sarge is in the chat room. So, I'll listen to what these guys have to listen to over there maybe for a little while and see what happens. But other than that, say God bless the Republic and tune in tomorrow night and we'll play the common law right there, common law. We'll see what we can get there going on that. It's about 45 minutes long. And then over the weekend we'll do our documentaries for the presidents. Anybody got any suggestions for what president they'd like to have a documentary on? Jefferson, Adams maybe, Lincoln, you know, sure. Jimmy Carter. Not Jimmy Carter. Oh, boy, yeah. So, anyway, everybody, so we'll get ready to wrap it up here. I guess we'll wrap it up here with a little bit of John Adams. How about that?
President recognizes Mr. Adams of Massachusetts.
Objects of the most stupendous magnitude. Measures which will affect the lives of millions, born and unborn, are now before us. And we must expect a great expense of blood to obtain them. But we must always remember that a free constitution of civil government cannot be purchased at too dear a rate, as there is nothing on this side of Jerusalem of greater importance to mankind. My worthy colleague from Pennsylvania has spoken with great ingenuity and eloquence. He has given you a grim prognostication of our national future. But where he foresees apocalypse, I see hope. I see a new nation ready to take its place in the world. Not an empire, but a republic. And a republic of laws, not men. Gentlemen,
We are in the very midst of revolution. The most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of the world. How few of the human race have ever had